on this week's program, a conversation with Emilio Gravano. The veteran double bassist plays his final concert as a member of the Philadelphia Orchestra this evening. Susan Lewis visits the Philadelphia Museum of Art's retrospective on the 20th century artist Arshil Gorky, whose work is seen as a bridge between surrealism and abstract expressionism. And Tom Keels takes us to Penn Treaty Park. The site celebrates a late 17th century agreement between William Penn and local Native Americans that made possible the founding of Pennsylvania. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Double bassist Emilio, or Lee Gravano, performs in his final concert as a member of the Philadelphia Orchestra this evening. This following a 50-year-long career as an orchestra musician. He played with the New Orleans Symphony for 2 years and was a member of the Baltimore Symphony for 5 years before coming to Philadelphia in 1967. In his more than four-decade-long career here, he has played under four music directors: Eugene Ormandy, Ricardo Muti, Wolfgang Sawallisch, and Christoph Eschenbach, as well as current chief conductor Charles Dutoit. I met recently with Lee Gravano backstage at the Kimmel Center. You've been a professional orchestra musician for 50 years now.
50 seasons, yes.
50 seasons. Before that, how did you first realize that you had a talent for music, and when did you realize that that would be best expressed through the double bass?
Well, I actually started playing the double bass in high school. I was actually 13 at the time, and we had people come around to the homerooms and say that there were instruments available for the orchestra if anybody wanted to start studying. Two of my brothers had played instruments before, piano and clarinet, and I went and checked out the instruments that they had available, and there was some violins and some basses, and for some reason, the bass just kind of appealed to me. I'm not sure why. I didn't know a whole lot about symphonic music at the time, at the age of 13. I had been listening to pop and various kinds of popular music, and I thought that the bass would be an instrument that could be used for a wide range of type of
everything.
Music. Yeah. So
it's also an incredibly powerful instrument for anybody who's ever stood behind or leaned against a bass and even made some... tried to extract some sound from it, even without having any knowledge of how to play it. It's a phenomenal experience,
yes.
Something you never grow tired of.
No, I mean, a lot of times my grandkids or just little kids at some of the family concerts we played, they'll come around and we'll show them a bass, you know, and we say, would you like to pluck it, you know, and their eyes get big, you know. And and it's just fun to do because you get such a sound out of it.
And it was always going to be the bass. There was never any temptation
Right, absolutely.
So tell us, after 50 years, why are you stopping now?
Well, I just feel that I still have some energy left. I want to have some energy left to do some other things. I've been studying classical guitar on and off for several years. I want to devote a little more time to that.
Easier to lift.
And the other thing about being in the orchestra is that, although it's got a wonderful, you know, a lot of positive aspects to it, some of the negative aspects are the traveling, you know, and as we get a little older, jet lag becomes more difficult to deal with and things
and
like that.
And you've been everywhere at this point as well,
several times.
Just about.
And any place I hadn't been, I don't think I'm going to go with the orchestra, so I may have to go on my own.
So people sometimes think, actually, that touring with the orchestra is a vacation where you play the occasional concert, but it's absolutely not. It's incredibly hard work.
It is very hard work. And it's frustrating, too, because sometimes you'll be in a place you haven't been before and you would love to be able to do a little, be a tourist for a couple of hours, and you don't have time to do that because there's no time. So maybe Carol and I will have some time to ourselves to do things that we haven't been able to do before.
Tell me about, if you will, your experiences or your recollections of the various music directors and chief conductors you've performed under. You started with?
Started with Eugene Ormandy, and there are many, many stories about Ormandy and about his prowess on the podium. One thing I remember very clearly about Ormandy was that he had an amazing intuitive ability to accompany soloists. He just could really stick with a soloist, and that helped us out a lot. The other thing is that he didn't give us very strong beats in some places, so we had to listen to each other a lot, and we became a very, very large chamber orchestra, listening to each other a lot, and that helped the ensemble quite a bit.
We were in China one time, and you, as a special treat, dragged me into the bass section during a rehearsal to give me a sense of what it was like to be part of the orchestra. And my first impression was, how can you hear anything over the sound that you and your colleagues in the bass section are making? It's very, very loud in there.
Well, I guess that's something you get used to. You get used to hearing the bass and feeling it as a foundation. And you try to tune your ear to what everybody else is doing, what certain other people are doing, so that you can match and come in with a soloist on a downbeat and things like that. And it's something you develop.
After Ormandy came Riccardo Muti. Yeah. Tell us about your experiences with him.
Well,
it was a big change.
A big change, yes. Riccardo Muti was a fabulous conductor and a musician. I was always disappointed that he didn't stay longer than he did. I've never quite understood how that all happened, but be that as it may, I had great admiration, still do have, for Riccardo Muti. Then, of course, Wolfgang Sawallisch came along after that, and I kind of look upon those years with Maestro Sawallisch as almost the golden years with the orchestra, because I think some of the best musical memories happened during the Sawallisch years.
What were his special skills as an interpreter and as a conductor?
Gee, that's a hard one. He did everything so well.
Great communicator.
Yes.
Even without raising a hand.
That's right, absolutely. I have a photograph at home that was taken, it was taken at the Curtis Institute. It's a wonderful photograph. He's looking at the cello players, conducting them, but his thumb is pointing at the violin players. And the meaning of it is very obvious. He's saying, listen to what they're doing.
Right.
And that's not something I don't think that can be taught. I think that's something he must have been born with.
And other stories of him when certain sections or even individual players would make mistakes, that he would raise his eyebrows in the manner of a benevolent uncle.
Right, right. But, I mean, he was a benevolent uncle, but you knew that underneath the surface there was a firmness that you didn't want to cross. You didn't want to go against. I mean, if there was something you were doing that he wasn't happy with, you wanted to fix it.
During that period, and it's one of the great stories about you that some people know, tell me how you met your wife, Carol. Because that would have been during the Sawallisch years.
We were having a strike at one point. I believe it was 1996. And I had a little petition that I had written up with a clipboard, and several of my colleagues and I were outside of the stage door of the Academy of Music asking passersby to read and sign the petition. And most of them were doing it very, very gladly. The petition was it wasn't butting heads with the management. It was like trying to find ways to get together and solve our problems. Anyway, this young lady came by, and I asked if she'd like to read our petition. She looked at it and said, well, I like what it says, but I'm not sure whether I ought to sign it because I'm on the board of directors of the orchestra. And, I said, well, I understand if you are not comfortable signing it. I'm perfectly, understand that. And she said, well, a lot of what you say in this petition is things I've been talking about in the boardroom. So I am going to sign it. And bottom line is she signed it. I was very impressed that she did, at her courage to do that. And eventually our strike was settled, and we went back to work. And Carol came up before the orchestra at one point and introduced herself at a rehearsal. She talked about some of the other problems that we were having, and what happened was she had said that she'd like to come and meet with some of the musicians, and either in groups or in singles, and talk about problems and how to solve future problems. And so a few months later, we were on tour in, I believe it was Amsterdam, and and I invited Carol to lunch to discuss orchestra problems. And
that was it. Your motives were pure, I take it.
Absolutely, absolutely pure. And so we got to know each other. We saw each other on a few occasions, and it went on from there.
And how long before you were married?
2 years.
See, the version of the story I heard is what? Met on the picket line, went for lunch, married 2 years later.
That's pretty much it.
After Meister Savalas retired, Christoph Eschenbach came in. What are your memories of his tenure here?
I think it was unfortunate that Maestro Eschenbach didn't have the same kind of entree to the orchestra that Wolfgang Savalas had.
Tough act to follow.
Yeah, anybody would have had a tough time following Savalas. But with Eschenbach, he kind of came in. We hadn't really seen him for a number of years before that. And I guess the chemistry was always a little bit of a problem. So I think that things worked out for the best, I suppose.
So you still have a relationship with him?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And you're now Charles Dutoit, of course, who's had a very long-standing relationship with the orchestra, is the placeholder for who will be the next music director. You won't play under the next music director, presumably.
That's correct, yeah. Well, unless I come back and sub some years from now.
You can't get it out of your blood, is that
right? Well, I have to tell you, a lot of people have asked me, what are you going to do after you retire? And I happened to come across a quotation by Louis Armstrong, in which he said, musicians don't retire. They quit playing when they don't have any music left in them.
And that's not for a while yet.
That's not yet.
Philadelphia Orchestra double bass Lee Gravano. He gives his final performance as a member of the Philadelphia Orchestra this evening at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall, and the last of this year's Glorious Sound of Christmas concerts.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
A new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art takes a fresh look at 20th century abstract expressionist painter Arshile Gorky. The first major retrospective since 1981, this show explores Gorky's creative process in context with his life story, hidden details of which have been revealed in recent biographies. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Arshile Gorky, a retrospective.
A tall, dark-haired man with a trim mustache wearing a T-shirt under a tan work coat looks out from the canvas. Behind him, through a window, a landscape is suggested by broad brushstrokes of greens, blues, and browns, the details of which, like those of his mitten-shaped hands, are left to the imagination. His pensive gaze suggests he knows something we don't. Exhibition curator Michael Taylor found this 1937 self-portrait evocative of the themes explored throughout the retrospective.
The use of color, the way in which the paintbrush has been used, the brushstrokes, and just the fact that he is this heroic figure. He's an artist who struggled and overcame many difficulties.
Arshile Gorky began life as Vostanik Adoyan in rural Armenia. He came to the U.S. as a teenager in 1920, having been driven from his home by Turkish troops and seen his mother die of starvation, a history he decided to keep secret as he pursued a career as a painter, first in Boston, then in New York. And he took a new name.
I think he felt that his own name was not artistic enough, so he invented a new life for himself as the cousin of the Russian writer Maxim Gorky.
While he kept the memory of his mother alive in drawings and paintings, he also embarked on a search for identity in his life and work, teaching himself by painting portraits, still lifes, and landscapes, experimenting with cubism and surrealism, emulating, with striking success, the art of Cézanne, Picasso, Matisse, and other modern European artists.
And he didn't just paint in their styles. He really adopted their mannerisms, their way of thinking. Cézanne had a beard, so he grew a beard. And all of this was a kind of self-creation. It's only in the 1940s that Gorky becomes Gorky. He finds his own way of working.
While Gorky's work imitating the European masters was challenged by some of his contemporaries as derivative, Philadelphia Museum of Art director Timothy Rubb sees it instead as an important foundation for what was to come. He says Gorky absorbed their work and then turned it to his own purposes.
That kind of dialogue or interaction between European and American art is very important for what happens in the 40s and the 50s. And Gorky was a critical player in that regard.
In 1941, Gorky married Agnes Magruder, affectionately known as Magooch, whose parents had a farm in Virginia. Gorky biographer Hayden Herrera, who, as a child, became part of the artist's family when her father married Gorky's widow, says this countryside recalled Gorky's own childhood in rural Armenia.
I think his marriage and having children and having access to the country completely brought him out and freed his creative process.
Gorky would take his drawing board out and sit in the fields.
He looked at the grass and he saw creatures and insects that would be transformed into very strange shapes.
What came out of it was a kind of organic abstraction. He's translating the natural world into a new visual syntax. And no one had made art like this.
These drawings led to paintings in which Gorky created further abstractions. Herrera, who lived with this art after Gorky died, says as children, she and his daughters were fascinated by these shapes.
We would look at these paintings and always try and find images in them, which is what you're not supposed to do, but we couldn't help it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Gorky said, I never put a face on an image. He didn't want you to find rabbits and people and horses, although you can find them very easily.
Gorky moved the art form forward, says Michael Taylor, in the way he portrayed emotions through paint. As just one example, Taylor points to the 1944 work called Scent of Apricots on the Fields. It shimmers with reds, oranges, yellows, and greens.
I almost get the sense that this is a tabletop with fruits and onions, but he moves it into a whole other realm. And it's through the use of color, that freedom of color, and also the way in which the paint is applied. It's stained, it's kind of pooling here. This is going to open up complete new possibilities for painting.
While the abstractions of the paintings may appear free-flowing, Gorky was precise in his process. A number of his drawings are marked by grids he created on top so as to accurately translate his compositions to canvas. He called his studio the Creation Chamber, and curator Michael Taylor uses this idea as a way to consider his art. Works, presented chronologically, show how he explored themes. Drawings are shown with the paintings to which they led, often created in multiple versions with various color combinations suggesting different moods.
He will do an original drawing, and then he'll make a finished drawing, he'll begin painting, and he might encounter problems or issues in the painting itself that will lead to another drawing. It was a process of abstraction where he's removing more and more.
Gorky's career progressed, although Herrera says he never made a lot of money. He took students, and the influential New York City art dealer Julian Levy showed his work in 1945. But the colorful, upbeat works of the early and mid-40s gave way to more somber works as a series of calamities darkened Gorky's life.
First, his studio burnt down. Then he was operated for rectal cancer and had a colostomy operation. And then the drawings changed.
After the fire in 1946, he creates a series of paintings called Charred Beloveds, with sooty images and textures, each painting more drained of color. After his operation to remove the cancer in 1947, he paints a work called Agony, its surface afire with reds and blacks. The end of his life, says Herrera, was miserable. He broke his neck in a car accident.
And his painting arm was paralyzed, and he thought he'd never paint again. And Magooch left him because he'd become kind of crazy and a little bit violent. And so she took the children to her mother to get them out of this somewhat dangerous situation. And then he killed himself.
At the time of Gorky's death, Michael Taylor says American abstract painting was just becoming internationally lauded.
And had Gorky lived, there's no question he would have been the leader of that moment. He would have been the artist that everyone would have looked to. He had opened the door to these artists.
Philadelphia Museum of Art director Timothy Rubb says Gorky's work propelled a new generation.
Clearly people like Mark Rothko, Willem de Kooning, Jackson Pollock, the great figures of the late 40s and 1950s, knew and were inspired by Gorky's work, and it served as a kind of platform for them to move on in their own work.
Rubb says the artist is acknowledged by many to be a painter's painter.
That is to say, artists learn a lot from looking at his work. He was a very, very gifted draftsman. He was enormously imaginative, formally speaking, in terms of the images he created. And he had a restless kind of desire to always experiment and push the boundaries of the medium forward.
This show demonstrates how Vostanik Adoyan, turned Arshil Gorky, did just that, starting out as a masterful chameleon and growing into an artistic leader of daring proportions, his work always intertwined with and informed by his life, especially the childhood he had once intended to leave behind.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Arshil Gorky, a retrospective, runs through January 10th at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Just over a mile south at the Delaware River sits a place where people have gathered since Philadelphia's earliest days. Penn Treaty Park may well be the least well-known, most historic site in the city. In 1682, William Penn concluded a land treaty with Native Americans there, establishing his tradition of peaceful coexistence for his new settlement. Now WRTI's Tom Keels takes us to Penn Treaty Park, which has survived for over 300 years, even as its surrounding community has undergone numerous changes.
On a recent Saturday, thousands of people converged on a 7-acre green space in a semi-derelict industrial area between I-95 and the Kensington waterfront. Overshadowed by an abandoned Pico power plant, Penn Treaty Park is hosting Shadfest, a celebration of the area's early days as a fishing center. But, according to historian Ken Milano, author of The History of Penn Treaty Park, this spot was an important meeting place centuries before the first Europeans arrived in America.
It was a major focal point for the local Native Americans, and they would meet here and have their council. It was also the terminus of a major transportation route. Today's Germantown Avenue, Old York Road, and Frankfort Avenue were all Indian trails. They all come together right around this point.
It was only natural that William Penn would pick this place, a village called Shackamaxon, with regular canoe ferry service, to draw up a pact with its Native American inhabitants on his first visit to the New World. In November 1682, Penn negotiated a treaty of amity and friendship with the Lenni Lenape tribe beneath an ancient elm tree. Ken Milano views this treaty as the first step in the founding of Pennsylvania.
The wampum belt that still exists, that's the one they gave to Penn, and they had one that they kept themselves. And on there you see Penn and Tammany holding hands, I think. So that's the written document. That's the Treaty of Amity and Friendship.
In the 18th century, the surrounding villages of Kensington and Fishtown grew into industrial powerhouses, home to fisheries, shipyards, and textile works. Despite this development, the Penn Treaty site remained untouched. Artists like Benjamin West and Edward Hicks created images of the treaty negotiations which became world famous. Today, many of these images have been gathered in a museum near the park by Kensington historian John Connors.
I thought there was a story that needed to be told that most people didn't know about it. It's an international story where now we have images from Italy, France, Germany. So that all over the world, people were enamored by the ideal of this fairness and friendship image that was started by Benjamin West.
After Benjamin West depicted Penn's treaty with the Indians in 1772, primitive artist Edward Hicks borrowed his central image and incorporated it into his numerous paintings of the peaceable kingdom, which show God's creatures living in harmony as predicted in the book of Isaiah. John Connors points out a caption to a Hicks painting which illuminates the significance of these iconic figures.
Penn's treaty with the Indians, made without an oath and never broken, the foundation of religious and civil liberty in the United States of America. Voltaire is also quoted as mentioning this treaty, never written, never broken. So they always would use this image because it is fairness and friendship.
In 1893, the city of Philadelphia made the treaty site into a public park. Today, Penn Treaty Park represents another kind of freedom. It's one of only two places in central Philadelphia where you can actually stand on the banks of the Delaware. Of the 1,100-plus acres of Delaware riverfront stretching from Allegheny to Oregon Avenues, only 8 are undeveloped and accessible. Penn Treaty Park accounts for nearly all of those 8 acres. Urban planner Brenna Herpman believes that the park will play a critical role in future plans to green the Delaware waterfront.
When you look at all of the plans for development south of here, to Center City, I mean, it looks like there's going to be another Center City coming to this part of the waterfront. It's crazy. There are many, many high-rises. And so Penn Treaty Park is precious in that way. It's an open space, and it'll be maintained as an open space. And it'll only become more important as the development comes.
Herpman, who works with the architecture and design firm of Studio Brian Haynes, sees Penn Treaty Park as a keystone of the Central Delaware Riverfront planning process. This plan, developed by Penn Praxis and the City of Philadelphia, proposes to create a network of parks, greenways, and watershed areas along the Delaware Riverfront. As an initial step in the project, Studio Brian Haynes is working with the Friends of Penn Treaty Park and other community groups to develop a master plan to redesign the space. Town meetings are being held, where local residents can offer ideas on how to improve the park while retaining its simple nature.
People in the neighborhood feel like Penn Treaty Park has been a little bit neglected, and it needs an infusion of interest and money, and, you know, it sort of needs a facelift. People like the tranquility of this park. They don't necessarily want it to be a recreational center. They like the sort of bucolic feeling of it. So we're trying to maintain a lot of the character that's here, but, you know, sort of bring in some other elements as well.
Kevin Musselman is a spokesman for the New Kensington Community Development Corporation, which offers support services to local homeowners and businesses. He sees the rich heritage of the Penn Treaty Park as a key to the soul of the neighborhoods of Fishtown and Kensington.
The history in terms of Revolutionary War, American Indians, all of those different layers of history that exist really contributes to the cultural identity that exists here. It's something that longtime residents hold dear. Even if they weren't alive at the time, they can tell you why Fishtown is called Fishtown, how it got its name. The fishmongers that used to live here and go down to Front and Market.
Meanwhile, with events like the Shad Fest, the residents of Kensington and Fishtown are striving to bring more Philadelphians to the spot where their city was actually born.
WRTI's Tom Keels. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under their music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.